If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
Captain! Captain!
Report.
Signatures detected!
Shields up!
Signatures detected!
Red alert!
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair! Chair!
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons? Klingons?
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica. Give me a moment here, Ben. My watch told me I need to breathe.
Does your watch just do that like every 3 minutes in your case?
I have no idea how it determines when to tell me that. Do you know?
I don't. I like the little breathing exercise.
I do too.
This is an Apple Watch feature that shows up sometimes that says, hey, like, why not like stop for a minute or two and just center yourself with a little breathing exercise? I would say that 8 times out of 10, if I take my watch up on its offer, I will be sitting on the couch doing my breathing exercise and my wife will come in and be like, what's wrong? What's going on? It always causes great concern, and then I answer her, oh, I'm doing my breathing exercise, and my watch goes, sorry, something interrupted your breathing exercise. It doesn't count.
Oh, that's such a bummer. Yeah. I love that your wife is concerned about your calm.
It is like really consistently that, and I usually read a book on my phone before going to sleep at night, but I've recently taken to doing the New York Times crossword puzzle and then reading a book before going to sleep at night. And apparently puzzle face is a very concerning look for my wife. Every time I'm in bed working on the puzzle, she'll come into the room and be like, is everything okay? What's going on? Like, I think she imagines I'm like looking at the news or something. And
your rest is very intense. And I know how hypocritical I sound in describing it that way.
Yeah.
It's hard to defend the space of recovery. Like, I know you've told me stories of like your wife tells you to just fucking, yeah, go for a walk. But if you come back from a walk during Shavasana, I'll fucking murder you.
Yeah.
And I get that, like that half an hour, whether it's breathing or yoga or whatever, like you really need it to yourself and you don't need the judgment of the faces that you make during.
I'm asking for 2 minutes, 14 breaths is all I'm asking for, and it's reliably interrupted.
Yeah. Yeah. You're better off just doing it in the shower, Ben. That's the place of ultimate privacy. That's the sanctuary.
Yeah. That sucks. That's also the title of the episode of today's episode of Greatest Discovery. We could get right into it if you want.
You didn't think we could tie it in, but we did it. Even though it sucked. It sucked a little bit, but it worked. Let's get this one into the can. It's Star Trek Discovery Season 3, Episode 8. Eight already. It's called The Sanctuary. A title that I don't believe relates to anything in this episode.
Did you notice that the episode description for this week was actually the episode description for the Will Wheaton hosted after show?
The description for The Sanctuary is, thank you so much for watching Star Trek Discovery.
This week, host Will Wheaton is joined by new stars Blue Del Barrio and Ian Alexander.
Hey, nerds.
LLAP, thank you for listening.
The Bridge Crew.
People are going to really start to hate us. We keep making fun of that.
I think people understand just how envious we are of that energy level. I'll have what Will Wheaton's having.
I know. This episode opens with Mug getting the business from Dr. Culber. This sounds like the scene that you described at the end of last week's episode. I liked how they're having this conversation about her mental health, and she walks behind him and picks up a paperweight and clearly thinks about braining him. What if we saw Culber brutally killed for a second time in 3 seasons?
Cut to credits. Hey guys, wild episode of Star Trek Discovery.
We've got Wilson Cruz, a former cast member from Star Trek Discovery, to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a real threatening paperweight there. You don't need a paperweight in the 30th century, though.
Yeah, there's no paper. I thought about that. What do they have that thing there for?
I don't know. It's just asking for trouble.
It looks like that Palantir from Lord of the Rings. You pick that thing up and accidentally the flaming eye is looking right into your soul.
Giorgio is mirror universe defensive about anything medical. And time works in an interesting way in this episode. We cut to her defenses against Culber into what has clearly become an acceptance of further study, because we cut to a scene in the next moment where suddenly Michael Burnham is there. And Culber has off-screen been trained on using this new medical technology.
Yeah, I wonder how long they have been in the future at this point. Like, a month?
If I'm Giorgio, don't I want to be scanned on the Starbase or whatever? Like, Culber's had his hands on this tech for what can't be longer than a week.
I thought a lot in this episode about how quickly this crew is up to speed on the ways of the future. Like, if you went back and like got the crew of a Spanish galleon from the year 1020 AD and put them on like a modern destroyer in the US Navy, and gave him like a crash course in 6 weeks. Like, here's how you do this. Do you think they could do it?
Ben, I'll do you one better. Both of our parents have been alive for decades.
Impossible to say how many.
Can we be sure that they know how to use the internet and email? They have not traveled through time to this point. They've known about it their all their lives since it's been invented. And I couldn't be sure of that.
My father-in-law attempting to get the Zoom call going for socially distanced Thanksgiving. It was like a 1 hour Zoom call where at least 25 minutes was him on the Zoom, also with my wife on the phone with him attempting to get it set up. At one point, my mother-in-law put on FaceTime and showed my wife the screen that they were looking at on his computer from their perspective.
That should be what's going on here. Like, someone at Federation HQ is FaceTiming with Culber, and Culber's looking at his device and he's like, it keeps flashing 12 and I keep hitting the button and nothing's happening.
It's the programmable matter. No, don't use the regular matter. Use the programmable matter.
Giorgio's like, should I come back later? Yeah.
He gets out his legal pad where he's written down step-by-step instructions for himself.
There's the real paper. That's why you need the paperweights. this the hostility that Georgiou has in basically every scene having to do with medicine reminds me
any other thing
or any other thing. It reminds me a lot of Locutus being examined by Crusher.
Oh,
like the way she kind of like stares around the room at things and makes her judgments and makes her threats against the doctor.
Yeah,
that felt like a real callback to me.
I like that. I like that call. Michael Burnham detects that she is not entirely welcome in the exam room. It's like when you're 16 and you go to your pediatrician and he has to do the testicular exam and your mom leaves the room.
So my mom never left the room, Ben.
That explains a lot.
Congratulations. Your mother must be very proud.
I wanted her to leave the room. God, I wanted that. I mean, I looked at my, for some reason, female pediatrician's eyes and I said, can't you do something about the mom in the room?
Could you persuade her, possibly? No? Okay.
All right.
Book needs to head home to his home planet of Quajon. This is a call to adventure that inevitably gets all the way up to Admiral Touch of Grey.
Quajon in this episode is going to be played by Liam Neeson.
What is that a reference to?
Qui-Gon from Star Wars.
I went down such a road of trying to think if I could come up with a runner using viral rap star Krayshawn that I just could not compute the Qui-Gon bit.
You would kick that comedy hacky sack at me and I would just let it fall to my feet. I couldn't possibly keep that in the air with you. So I'm glad.
Okay.
I mean, it would have been neat for me to admire, but I could not have joined in.
Yeah. I watched several Krayshawn videos on YouTube and I enjoyed them. So
yeah,
I don't know if she's still active.
Maybe you could reach out, do a wellness check.
Yeah. So the deal with his planet is that the burn, when it happened, didn't just fuck up starships. It also damaged subspace. And one of the things that meant for his planet was that their moon changed orbit. And these things called sea locusts came out of the oceans and started fucking up all the crops on his planet. And I got the sense that his planet is a pre-warp civilization. Like when they talk to the Admiral, he starts talking about how Osyra has used like her power to kind of make vassal states of all these pre-warp civilizations. He's clearly really burned up about it because he hates prime directive violations. And the Emerald Chain doesn't give any fucks about them. Mm-hmm. So hence the like no replicators on Book's home planet, I guess.
I mean, all of this is suggested in dialogue, Ben, but when we finally get there, it looks like leaf peeping season in Vermont. Like nothing about what we see on Quajon visually suggests the kind of blight that we're being told about, right?
Yeah, well, he talks about their harvest, and it seems like their harvest has something to do with the trees.
Yeah.
So I don't, that is not elucidated super well.
We cut to a Rush song that actually tells that story, and it's like, it's very long, even by Rush song standards. I think Robs might know what I mean.
Okay, I sure don't.
I think it's weird that Book asks Michael Burnham for permission to go do this thing, to go check in on the brother. And Michael's like, look, Quajon is very far away. It's unlikely we'll be able to get that kind of permission. Or if we don't, like your ability to get there without warp drive is going to take 2 weeks or something.
Right. So she doesn't want him taking a work trip that lasts that long. So she suggests they take the entire Discovery And this is a rare scene where she suggests a mission that Saru and the Admiral like are both pretty quick to agree is a mission worth doing. Like the Admiral's like worried about risking the Disco for this, but it, like Saru gives him like a mental framework for why they should do it, and they just go do it.
Saru's like, look, Admiral stock photo of early onset gray hair. We need to make a Star Trek Discovery episode here, and this sounds like the makings of a nice tight episode with a single planetary mission that we can go fix. What do you say? And the Admiral's like, we got an episode here. Go get it.
All right, people.
Just make sure you get enough coverage.
We get a little interlude back on the Rust Belt planet where Rin and Book were enslaved with Talor talking to Osyra. We meet Osyra finally here.
Yeah, the Wicked Witch of the Emerald Chain.
Mm-hmm. Those nails, man. Those are scary.
Yeah, are they like Jackie Joyner Kersey nails? You can tell that she's of the ruling class and not of the labor class with nails that long.
I feel like you really have to live in a programmable matter world with nails like that, because like typing is much easier when the keys are floating up to touch your fingers.
Right. Osyra does not seem particularly nice to her nephew here. Her nephew is really in a state of groveling.
Yeah. He doesn't really understand why he's in as much trouble as he is. And she reveals that it is because he let Rin get away. Rin was the real prize. And she kills Talor over this. Like
Talor asks for a pardon and actually like attempts to bribe Osyra in order to get it.
Yeah. And like as fucked up as the Justice Department is, the Justice Department even opens a investigation into this.
Right.
It's that corrupt.
Where is this transworm? It's on Osyra's ship. Is that what you gathered?
I think she's got a rancor pit on her ship.
You know what I liked about this scene is the detail of the wet prison bars that Talor goes up to and then grasps. Because Talor kind of turns to camera, and camera's on the other side of the prison bars as he's talking to Osyra when the transform comes out from behind. And gah. To make sure your prison bars are sparkling clean, I like to rent a pressure washer for my local home center.
You think that they built this set with a little give in it so that they could shake it so that the goo dripping off those bars would like actually shake it and jostle loose?
Do you think we're at the point of digital goo? I wasn't so sure it wasn't. I'm not even sure the bars were actually there.
I think those bars are there. They're the digital goo.
Real bars for my real friends.
Goo
digital
bars
for my fake friends.
Yeah. Do you think that like they let the transworm in when they're going to kill a Talor, but this room is used for multiple purposes, like coming. So
I get the sense that this transworm is especially hungry, or maybe even not a great transworm, because I don't get the sense that Talor is entranced at the time of his death. I believe the suffering is great and Osyra lied to him.
Yeah, maybe the transness of these worms has been oversold a little bit, which kind of flies in the face of them being a scary threat, right? Like, Sarlacc is going to digest you in exquisite pain over 1,000 years.
Right.
The transworm, it's painless. You won't feel a thing.
Yeah, that's what they say. But everyone who says that hasn't been entranced by a transworm and then eaten.
That's true. Who got spit out? That was Michael Burnham has been in... a transworm, right?
Yeah, she's been in it. All up in it.
Up in them guts.
Yeah.
What do we have in the meantime?
So after the theme, we get an exposition walk with Tilly and Saru. Tilly having been a newly minted XO in the previous episode.
XO as executive assistant.
That's really it, isn't it?
we never saw Riker doing this kind of work with Picard. Presumably they did it occasionally, right? Like he's sometimes like working on duty rosters and stuff.
You know who really made Riker do that with was Jellico.
Like, yeah.
Like Jellico tillied Riker in TNG the way that Saru is doing that to Tilly here.
Man, is Saru more of a Jellico type captain?
He's not nearly the hard ass. Well, Jellico is 1,000 times the captain that Saru is. Let's be clear.
Yeah. One of the things that is set up in this is a bit that I got the sense is going to be with us for more than this episode, which is the gag of what is Saru's catchphrase going to be when he tells somebody to do something.
Right. Yeah. What's his engage going to be? Everyone needs an engage. I think this is an instance of the show talking about itself, because I've got to imagine a conversation exactly like this happened in the writer's room when they were trying to figure out what friend of the podcast Anson Mount was going to say when he took the ship to warp or they did a black alert. And
I kind of feel like Anson Mount just came in and was like, here's what I'm going to say.
When we sit down with Anson Mount again, we'll have to ask about that. Like, that was you, right?
Yeah. He's going to be like, hell yeah.
they're unable to agree on what that's going to be. That's the hanging thread.
Yeah, and none of the options are good. Like, crucially, they all kind of suck. But they end this conversation by walking into the science lab where Stamets and Adira and team have kind of worked out the combination of the black box data and the data that they got from Navarre, and they actually have the like ground zero of the burn, the nebula. It's the Verubin Nebula. Now this is a nebula that's made with Swiss cheese, sauerkraut, Russian dressing, and a vegan pastrami.
Oh, I'm so happy. We always do this. It always works.
It's delicious. You wouldn't think that you could make a nebula with vegan pastrami taste this good.
It's an idea too good for Star Trek Las Vegas. They'll never put it on the menu, even though they should.
Oh, man. Yeah. Like that dumb hot dog bar. Give me a fucking break. Give me Verubins.
Yeah. Verubins all day. How many Verubins did you have on Saturday, Ben? You're looking you're looking a little flushed.
I had one for breakfast and one for lunch.
You know, it's a Verubin makes a great breakfast when you put an egg on it, which I did. Ben,
that's called a Verubin Madame.
Significant moment here when they start listening to the nebula and they hear the sound coming from it. And it's the song. It's the song that that the Barzans hummed. It's the song that Gray plays on the cello. It's the earworm.
That's weird.
Of the galaxy that they hear in this thing. And then Saru's like, no, turn the bass up. Turn the bass up in my headphones.
There's some really intense ECUs on Saru's eyes and ears in this scene.
Yeah.
That, I mean, this is a Frakes episode, and I feel like one thing that Frakes has got to love about directing new Trek is how high quality the makeup is, because you can go in for this ECU and you don't see where the latex meets real skin.
Yeah.
It looks awesome.
It's a close-up to an amount of latex that that I feel like Britt Hume would appreciate the most.
Now there's a 2%er, Adam.
Yeah.
So they've got their ground zero, but this base also reveals that what is sending this signal out is in fact a Federation vessel.
And this is where the entire episode shifts, right? Because now this is the mission. No one cares about Book's mission to his homeworld. We've got a Federation ship in trouble. All other concerns are secondary. We've got to head right out on this rescue mission, Ben. And They don't.
Sorry, Adira has to do hours and hours worth of algorithm programming.
This part sucked because, like, we cut from Stamets to Adira back and forth, and Stamets is like, yeah, I've got an employee here who can really do the job, and also I'm enforcing a timeline on the labor without their involvement at all. And I cringed. Adira's cringing for a reason that is totally different from the reason I'm cringing, which is a boss just fucking enforcing a project on you without your involvement at all.
Oh, Adam is a great producer. He'll have this video done by the end of the week. And you're like, whoa, no, I will not.
Yeah.
I didn't really understand what the algorithm needed to be, because it seems like they have the location.
Yeah.
Did you get that?
Nope.
I didn't either.
Did not get.
I think this is particularly a problem just because we have had so many episodes so far this season where they're like, Earth, okay, let's check it out. And then they're like there in the next scene.
Right.
That this being the big like myth arc of the season, like why didn't we just jump directly to this nebula?
I don't understand what rises to the level of immediate need anymore.
Yeah. I mean, presumably there is something important about this algorithm, but
I think this is on Saru again.
Yeah.
So when the meeting's over, Adira's like, hey, Stamets, gotta talk to you about something. First, I set my own timelines. You fucking asshole.
Yeah. Like, you work in the engineering section. You know how it works. You ask the person that's going to do the work. They tell you four times as much time as they think they need. And then they preserve their reputation as a miracle worker.
You call me a genius every other scene we have together. Why don't you let me establish the timeline?
Yeah. Also, Stamets, keep calling me she. It's not going to work anymore.
I'm going to slap you in the goddamn face if you keep calling me she. And here's the thing, Ben. This is a significant moment for Adira because they're asking Stamets to address them with their preferred pronouns. And this is a big moment for Adira. And it's received positively by Stamets. But while it is a significant scene, I feel like the significance of this scene has more to do with today imprinting on the show and the writer's voice over a character's voice instead of what motivates Adira to make a decision to hide their choice of pronouns up until this scene and then the thing that makes them reveal them. Because I don't know anything about Adira's reasons for this.
Yeah.
And I would like to.
Adira wasn't even in the last episode, and I would have loved some scenes of Adira exploring that. You know, the thing like we talked about last episode is that like our culture gives us bad heuristics for making assumptions about what gender somebody might think of themselves as. And then, you know, like people grow up getting called which, you know, one pronoun or another, and it doesn't always match up. So like taking that as given, what is this character's journey with that? And instead of getting that, it almost feels like Adira doesn't have a journey because they didn't bother with giving us.
I agree with you so much, Ben.
I would love to have gone on the journey with them.
We got an episode, I feel like it was the second episode we got with Adira, where I believe it was Stamets and maybe even Culber. No, it was Stamets and Tilly use she in Adira's presence, I want to say like half a dozen times. And yeah. I noticed it, and it was the reason I called Adira she from then on, because I thought that was what they preferred. But we never get the suggestion at all that that's the wrong term to use, because we never get the benefit of a cut to Adira's face at any moment to register any kind of hurt. And we're deprived of that journey, like you're saying, because we don't ever get that subtext in the scenes up until now.
But also, like, maybe Adira wasn't hurt in those moments because Adira hadn't solved that Rubik's Cube in their own head at that point that would make sense.
Yeah.
All this is to say, like, Adir is a really interesting character and has clearly had an interesting journey that we haven't gotten the benefit of seeing on screen.
No, we haven't. And it's important to us now in a way that it shouldn't be on the show.
Right. This far in the future, we hope that a person who changes their pronouns for whatever reason, whenever they choose to do it, as many times as they choose to do it, it's not a big deal.
I am a privileged cisgendered person, and I wish so often that moments like this were treated as more normal than they are. I feel like almost making it the big deal cuts against the message, the ultimate message, which is that it should be normal.
And that Star Trek presents a ideal, better future where it just is normal.
Yeah. So this was a scene with some friction for us for a couple of reasons. One, got to change the mission, guys. Two, maybe work on the Adira scene a little more.
On the other hand, I could see how having very few major television depictions of somebody coming out like this being like super meaningful and a relief in some ways, you know? I think that there's a tension between a totally good intention of the representation aspect of this, like showing an experience that lots of viewers can relate to but haven't seen in television before, and the relief that that must bring to them, but also Star Trek being a utopian future in which the struggle of that would hopefully be greatly diminished.
There's been a tension in media since media was media about the representation of race and gender of people and its relationship to how they're represented.
Yeah.
You know, like is it enough that there's representation, or is it the way that the people are being represented? Elsewhere on the ship, Burnham and Book take another exposition walk of their own.
They've changed into Quajon local garb.
Yeah, some leaf peeping uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
Book mentions some friction with his brother. He's like, "Look, Michael, I'm excited to take you home to meet a member of my family, but I don't know. Things aren't exactly great between us. And also, like, the condition of the planet, not as good as I've left it."
Yeah. My brother Kahim, you know how what I do is I go around and I find transworms and bring them to safe places for them to live? He kind of does the exact opposite of that.
You remember transworms, right, Michael?
I mean, Michael was part of the, like, transworm liberation front for an entire year before Discovery showed up.
Yeah, she was the Yasser Arafat of the transworms. Burnham is exactly how you want your special person to be ahead of a trip home to meet a family member. She's like, "Yeah, it's going to be fine. You don't have to pre-defend your weird family members. Like, families are weird, and I get that. My mom's a co-op malat. You think there's anything your brother's going to throw at me that is going to be worse than that?"
Yeah.
"She pulled my pants down in a courtroom.
I'm lucky she didn't cut my head off with that fucking sword that she brought."
Yeah. So they're walking to the bridge, and they arrive in time for their trip to Quajon. It's a trip that Detmer's going to take them on with her newly installed OS at her station. She's made some tweaks there. Awosakun is legit questioning her choices here, but not enough to make them rise to the level of telling anyone else about them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I kind of feel like Awosakun, in trying to be supportive friend to Detmer, who's, you know, doesn't have 100% of her confidence at the moment, maybe. Like, I sort of wonder if this, like, "Hey, you're great. You don't need backup systems on your control panel," is like a little bit
enabling.
Enabling, yeah.
Yeah.
But anyways, they jump, and they jump from within the distortion field surrounding Federation HQ. I feel like last time they like pulled the car out of the garage before they did their jump.
I was trying to remember the timeline there. Like, was that a jump made before the meeting of the captains in the round where it was revealed that they had the spore drive? Like, do they have to leave the cloak to do it to keep it a secret, and now they don't have to?
So that people looking out the windows of the USS Nog didn't see what they were doing?
Yeah. Yeah, the Nog's only got one good window, though.
So they arrive at Quajon, and the Viridian is 30 minutes out. This is a heavy cruiser that they pick up on sensors coming in at high warp. It's a ship that is named after everybody's favorite planet to crash a saucer section into.
Don't you think it's weird that the ship is named that? That's the planet where Kirk died. It's the planet where the little D died.
Isn't it also the name of the tracking beacon that Spock put on Kirk's shoulder in Undiscovered Country?
If you want to name your ship something that engenders some fear in a Federation, I think you either name it Viridian or you name it Wolf 359 or something like that.
Yeah, I like it. I like that a lot.
The very name gives you the chills.
This is where the D went down.
Right.
I mean, that kind of tracks, right? Like, I feel like the U.S. would commission a warship with the name of like a famous battle where the U.S. had like a big victory or whatever.
Yeah, that makes sense.
First thing that happens when they arrive is we cut down to Six Bay where Mug walks in, and she is in an unusual costume. She basically says she's dressed up like cum.
Yeah.
When she walks in. And this is an outfit that is meant to enhance some kind of scan. What they're going to do is scan her body down to the atomic level to see if they can figure out what's going on with her. And it's Dr. Culbert and Dr. Pollard doing this project.
I couldn't stop thinking about how hot and sweaty her feet have to be. I always notice a bodysuit that has footies.
Yeah, they're kind of it's a very like form-fitting footie pajama.
Yeah.
Do you think it has like the butt flap of a union suit so that you can go to bathroom without getting entirely undressed?
She has a medical emergency later and she's clearly like very sweaty. Like I don't think they added sweat to her in those scenes. I think it's just the bodysuit working as advertised.
That sweat that would be going into socks, but it has to come out of her forehead.
Yeah.
There's also a scene with Stamets and Adira. They're having a little jam sesh, and Adira is, I guess, taking a break from this urgent coding project that Stamets has put them on.
Are these Adira's quarters?
I don't know.
Because they're nicer than Tilly and Michael Burnham's. I think your quarters are nicer if you've got a grand piano and a cello inside. And a window. They've got all of those things.
It gave me kind of fancy recording studio vibes. So maybe this is something that you can like sign up for. Like when I was in college, there were, you know, for kids in the music program, there were music practice rooms in the basement of my dormitory that you could check out for, you know, an hour and a half at a time. So maybe that's what's going on.
You know what else is strange about this scene? Is that Star Trek speaks in a language that goes like, crew person does a thing. There's a chirp at the door. The crew person says, come. That person enters. And then they have a conversation. Adira's playing their instrument. And Stamets enters and sits at the piano, but it's not shown in coverage. It's only shown in sound. We cut from Adira's face to Stamets at the piano. And that's how that sequence works. It felt like something was missing there.
It almost felt like a dream sequence or something because it feels so outside of Adira's urgent coding project, and also that like that visual language feels different. Like in the previous scene, Culber and Dr. Pollard are standing in Six Bay and the door rings and Culber says, come, and Mug walks in her seaman suit and he says, whoa, not literally.
I feel like there's a super cut out there of this moment every time it happens on TNG, and it is 17 hours long.
Yeah. I also thought it was interesting that Stamets was sitting at a grand piano, but when he says, why don't we play something, G minor, and then he picks up a saxophone and starts playing Yakety Sax? Did not see that coming.
It's so hard for an actor to pull off the whole not a trained musician playing a musical instrument thing. And I think Frakes blocks this nicely. It does not put a lot of pressure onto Anthony Rapp, like, to make his fingers look like they're doing a thing. They don't give him that long lingering panning of like an actor with their eyes closed, like really feeling what they're doing, that so often just doesn't work.
Yeah.
I think this is an actor's director doing an actor's director thing and getting him a little bit off the hook here, which is good.
I always wondered about that as a person who I took piano and drum lessons when I was a kid for years. I took piano lessons.
Yeah, what class do they tell you to close your eyes during?
I was never any good, so I don't know if that's something that like comes with like really being one with your instrument to the point where you're really like expressing yourself emotionally and not just be like, oh fuck, what key do I hit next or whatever. But I knew kids that were really good at their instruments and saw them do that, and it always seemed like very performative to me. Like, oh come on, Derek. Like, everybody knows you're good at piano. You don't also have to close your eyes and rock back and forth.
I always felt the same. And it was always something that felt to me that only adults could do that. Like, you couldn't possibly have that kind of reservoir of feeling as what I'm going to call a child, you know?
I think it is largely out of envy that I felt that, but I felt that in a big way.
I feel that way about anyone showing an emotion, to be honest.
Or talent, you know? Like, fuck you!
So when Stamets starts playing the entertainer, it is very confusing to Adira, who doesn't quite know what to do with their cello.
I thought we were doing that lullaby from the stranded ship that we are not rushing to the aid of. What are you doing?
No kidding. Yeah. What do you want to play at the funeral when we arrive too late to save anyone? The main takeaway of this scene is that Adira has been having some Esri Dak style body and mind confusion. They keep waking up to a new version of themselves, and it's been kind of a stressful thing.
Yeah. Gray has gone silent, sort of a demergence.
And that might be related, right? Gray's disappearance and the appearance of all the other Daxes on a given day might be a related thing. Stamets is like, the music is going to fix this. I think. I'm not a doctor. Mm-hmm. So in G, Tilly's briefing Saru about the complications on Quajon, W/R/T, the protective shield that's there over much of the area that Book and Michael Burnham are going to be in.
They've beamed down to the planet and they are attempting to make contact with his brother, but their icon starts like blipping around on the screen, and it means that they're going to be hard to reach on radio and impossible to locate precisely or beam out.
Tilly looks down at the mouse and sees that the mouse isn't on the iPad, and that's why the cursor's jumping all over the place.
I've had this thing for like 2 weeks. I don't know what happened, but I keep getting like one little hair on the optical sensor on my mouse, and it's driving me crazy. I don't know where these hairs are coming from.
You think Tilly doesn't know all about a problem with hair getting in front of her mouse sensor? That is a huge problem for her.
Rin kind of storms in here, and I really love the way Tilly just stomps him.
Which one of you is the captain?
Try again, this time with the respect the rank deserves.
She's like, all right, Karen, back it off.
This scene is a little more fun when you know that the actors are married, you know?
Yeah, totally. I really liked the interactions between Rin and Tilly in this episode, and knowing that they are IRL an item made them much more fun.
Yeah, that's big fun. He seems very concerned about the threat of the Viridian. He's chilled to the bone about Osyra.
He does not trust the Federation, but he trusts Osyra a lot less. Because he, yeah, like his goal when he comes in is just like, get me off your dirty ship. And when Saru explains that the Viridian is inbound, he's like, I would like to stay, actually.
Right.
We cut down to the surface of this planet, and it's a beautiful, you know, like they really got the fog machines going in this forest in a big way. And they filled the atmosphere with these little blue critters that are the sea locusts.
It's a beautiful place before the sea locusts.
Yeah, totally. And this effect is really great. Like I liked the critters. I kind of wished somebody had like physically interacted with one, like let them land on their nose like a butterfly.
Or accidentally crunched one under a boot. But as it is, Book can ask the locust to move out of the way, and he does that with his...
He has, like, extremely limited Aquaman powers,
he
I
does.
Want to say.
Yeah.
He can ask politely. They're walking in the forest, and they get set upon by bandits who kill them and take their money, and we cut to the theme song.
Hey, guys! Thank you so much! We'll do it as long as it's funny to us. So back in Six Bay, we got to check in with Mug to see how the body scan is going. And she has a bit of a medical emergency mid-scan.
Yeah.
She has one of these flashbacks that we've seen before. We see the body, we see the blood, we see the dagger. We get the yell of Sun once again. And she sort of busts out of the scan. This is a moment where Culber and Hollard are like, should we shut off the scan? And Culber's like, hell no, we're almost done. We got to finish the thing. They're arguing about this, but it's Georgiou that actually busts herself out of it.
Does Georgiou have the same thing as that Barzan guy on the seed ship?
Oh, like being out of phase?
He was in a transporter when they get hit with a solar flare or something. So... Maybe they came up with the wrong explanation for why that was happening to him. Is that possible?
When I shallow fry some food for dinner, oftentimes, like later on that night, my face will look like this. Like, really got to go after it with a tea tree oil pad cleanser on there.
I really recommend getting a splatter screen, Adam.
Yeah, I should do that. Culber produces a splatter screen for Georgiou in this scene.
Sets it on the rim of the pot.
Pollard's like, no, we don't need that. We're using future tech here.
How fucking cagey is Mug that she is like busting out of the bio bed after a medical emergency, but still with it enough to like pickpocket one of these sensors that they put on her?
How well does one clip show device work, though? Don't you need two? Also, I think if your patient is phasing, I think you gotta, I mean, look, I don't like saying this any more than you're gonna like hearing it, but I think you gotta I think you have to restrain her. You can't have her walking around the ship if she's phasing around. That's how accidents happen.
You can't just let her be like, all right, well, anyways, ta-ta, bye-bye.
That's dangerous.
Yeah. Back on the planet surface, we visit Kahim's house, which is pretty nice, pretty well-appointed pad this dude lives in.
He has what I'd describe as a suspicious amount of chandeliers.
Yeah, I mean, Book kind of makes fun of him for being as well-paid as he is, because literally, like, what Kahim does is capture transworms and give them to Osyra, which is the way this planet compensates her for the use of the repellent that they use to keep these locusts at bay. If the locusts are near the trees, it messes up their ability to feed their population, and they've sort of sold out the transworms to contract with Osyra for this technology. It's a little unclear like what the repellent is, but it is clear that they haven't had access to it in a long time because the locusts are everywhere.
What's clear is that none of the produce on the planet can be marked as organic because they're using this pesticide to get rid of the locusts.
Yeah. That's
sad. Not good.
But this is the scene where we realize that this is actually a trap. Kaim was asked by Osyra to do something to summon Book because she knows that Rin and Book are traveling together. She wants Rin back. And
Osyra's like, you got to do something to summon Book. And Kaim's like, well, I could send him a message. Osyra's like, yeah, do that. That's the big plan.
Her ship shows up. It's a big chonker. And
I like how it also has separate nacelles. Like parts of it are unconnected from the rest.
Yeah, I noticed the design of Osyra's ship on a screen in the background of the bridge in an early scene of this episode. I think like right when they're about to leave space dock, they've got a diagram of her ship up on one of the screens in the background. And I was like, oh, that's a bad continuity mistake.
Yeah.
Should not have had that up there.
No.
But it's a cool ship. She basically makes it clear war is on the line with like it's Federation v Emerald Chain if she doesn't get Rin. That's the stakes. And everybody played right into her hands. She got exactly what she wanted.
Everybody gets a Kenan reacts here to Osyra's FaceTime, her hollow FaceTime, I guess.
Owosukun and Detmer look at each other and Owosukun goes, that jaw, what the fuck?
Ben, I was just going to say that. What is up with the chin continuity with Osyra? Osyra did not look like this earlier.
I feel like all of the Orions have kind of lantern-y jaws, though.
But on the on the Rust Belt planet, Osyra didn't have this jaw there.
She didn't?
No.
Maybe it was just an angle thing.
I think you need to choose a tasteful lens when you're doing the FaceTime, Osyra. Maybe go with an 85 and set the camera back a couple more feet.
The FaceTime adds 15 pounds to your jaw.
Yeah. Osyra should get into boxing with that lantern.
She's got some major jaw in that. I'm looking back.
It's not real because in the earlier scene, she does not have that jaw. And then the later scene when Osyra FaceTimes with Kaim, also not the same jaw.
I think they must be putting a prosthetic on the actor's face, but maybe like shows up bigger in some scenes than others or something.
It's so noticeable.
Yeah. It's wild in the FaceTime.
Yeah. This starts a lot of cross-cutting between Book and Michael Burnham's storyline and the situation on the disco. Like, an intense amount of back and forth happens, which I don't think that we're going to do for the purposes of this episode.
No.
But we'll try our best to summarize.
We've talked for so long.
This episode is really long. And we cut out most of our arguments.
Right. I mean, we don't. Rob does, but... The deal is like, we need to know what this is all about. Why is Osyra so freaked out about Rin specifically? Because he didn't come across as being the linchpin to her operation when they found him enslaved and antennaless on that other planet.
No, he had his linchpins cut off.
Saru calls him up to the bridge and is like, what gives, man? Like, why is she so crazy about getting you? And he won't spill the beans. He it seems like he knows, but he won't say why.
Right. And then Saru uses Starfleet protocol to justify a kind of response to Osyra's attack on the planet. And this is underway at this point. Osyra has, just before this, demanded that Kaim give her Book and Michael Burnham. And when he kind of equivocates, she starts bombarding the planet from orbit.
Yeah, she's like, you have 5 of your Earth minutes. Never mind, you don't, actually. I'm just going to start shooting everybody.
This is one of the best effects I think the show has ever done. This idea of the planet surface almost being underwater beneath the shield system and the bombardment happening just above the treetop. That was really well done.
It looked so cool. And yeah, so they come up with this kind of diplomacy hack. Specifically, Tilly does. She says, why don't we send Book's ship out there to fuck Osiris' ship up, and we'll have Detmer pilot it, but then we'll be like, Detmer really fucked up, and we're gonna punish her because she did that against orders, and it wasn't a Federation ship that did it, so it'll get us off the hook. It won't start a war between the Federation and the Emerald Chain. Saru loves this idea, and we get a pretty intense space battle sequence with Detmer and Rin on board Book's ship.
I could barely hear them talk to each other because Beastie Boy's Sabotage was playing so loud.
Yeah. When the red alert starts, Mug sort of gets screwed by the bell because she's just about to hack into the ear pod that she stole from Dr. Culber when he comes up behind her and the red alert has started, and she says she knows she's dying, and he says, it's not exactly what you think it is. Let's go talk next episode.
Let's put a pin in this. Yeah. For a week.
Yeah.
Screwed by the Bell also was the working title of This Ain't Saved by the Bell XXX. Just want to say.
Michael Burnham and Book leave to try and shore up one of the orbital defense systems because there's kind of like, we've got 5 minutes left on these shields before the photon torpedoes that are raining down on the planet start to break through. And they're running through the forest when Kaim's people set upon them with those wood rifles, which are revealed to shoot arrows. I was shocked by this.
I love future wood. The look of these rifles is so cool.
It's a pre-warp society, so they wouldn't have phasers, maybe.
Yeah.
Or disruptors, or laser beams, or whatever. Yeah. They shoot arrows. Michael Burnham shoots a guy in the chest with an arrow.
Ouch.
Yeah, they beat these guys in a Star Trek fight. I mean, it's all like radio silence. They can't communicate with the ship and stuff. But Detmer and Rin's gambit works out insofar as they disable the Viridian and cause Osiris to have to warp out of there, but not before kind of promising, surely you know this means war.
Right. And back on the planet, it's kind of a sad moment because like it's sort of a mixed feeling, because while Osiris is leaving, that's good news. The bad news is famine's back on the menu, boys.
Right. Like Kaim is not doing what Book would do, but you understand why Kaim is doing it. He's preventing a planetary famine, and like it's a deal with the devil, and he knows that. He is a character that is not totally beyond redemption at this point, but because Osiris has left, he feels like he has just doomed his own kid to certain death. And
can I ask you a question, which is, don't you need to see some inhabitants on this planet that aren't just Kaim's thugs? Like, don't you need to see families and farmers and what have you to really get the stakes? Because I think we know 5 people on this planet and we're being told this is a planetary disaster in progress.
Yeah, it's a pretty classic Star Trek thing of there don't really seem to be that many people here.
Yeah.
But it's also just a classic TV thing, you know? Like, I was watching Curb Your Enthusiasm the other night, and it was an episode where Larry David, like, runs into an Uber driver he had earlier in the episode. It's like, that doesn't happen in Los Angeles, like, ever. Like, Larry David lives in an LA where you bump into people you know all the time, and it's just not a thing.
This is something that David Letterman said one time. He said, when you're a famous, the entire world feels like a small town. So maybe that's how it feels when you're Larry David.
Or Kaim.
Yeah.
A suggestion is made, because Michael Burnham has seen what Kaim and Book can do with their powers of an empath. She says, what about Wonder Aquaman powers activate?
She's like, how much time do we have left on this episode? Oh, shit. This is where I need to save the entire story. She saves the day here by connecting the deflector dish to the brother's book.
Yeah, they somehow like build a resonance out of the mental powers that they have that causes all of the...
It's not the deflector dish. Don't at me. It's like the areola of the saucer amplifies what they're doing. The chanting. Yeah,
the ship lactates all over the planet's surface, and the sea locusts take a hint and head back to the ocean.
Get our godshot here, though.
Mm-hmm.
Which is nice.
I loved this sequence. It was really pretty, and. Again, the Discovery has solved a 120-year-old problem for another planet it has visited.
Pretty nice hit rate for them at this point.
Yeah. Earth is like one of the few that remains unsolved, right?
What you want to do is build up a winning streak before going into this nebula and trying to save a Federation ship in distress. Maybe that's why they put it off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Need a few more reps.
It's like in any like RPG, you want to like grind a little bit and get your stats up before you go fight the boss battle.
Yeah.
We get a little scene in the mess hall. It's how Detmer got her macho back. And there's a little moment between Tilly and Rin about why Tilly really admires what Rin did. And he spills the beans on Osira. And I think this is really interesting. The Emerald Chain feels to me like a direct analogy to the Federation before the burn. They are running out of dilithium and doing increasingly desperate things to preserve what they've got. And Rin is one of the only other people that knows aside from Osira.
And now Tilly knows.
That's why she wanted him back. Also, why wouldn't Osira just kill him? Why did she cut his antenna off and... put him on Slave Planet.
We got to make a season of TV here, Ben.
Yeah. I think it will be very interesting if they find a way to tell the story of why she pulled that punch. Because it does seem to like defang her a little bit as a villain if she was merciful to Rin in some way.
Well, and also, doesn't it remove Osira's need to kill Rin if Rin tells... everyone on the bridge the big secret instead of hiding it in that moment? If the secret's out, it doesn't make him a target anymore.
Right.
His motivation should be telling as many people as possible.
Yeah, but he also has lived an entire life of being told not to trust the Federation, and he needed to see them do this good deed
to change his
mind.
Yeah. It's nice to see Tilly go and sit by the lonely guy in the lunchroom, though. That's a very Tilly thing to do. Tilly did that with Michael Burnham in the first season, remember?
Tilly rules. Yeah. Tilly's always doing cool ass shit like that.
Yeah.
Michael Burnham shows Kaim's son the gross lizard man that lives on the ship. And Kaim and Book have a nice little moment together. I feel like it's kind of Book bragging that he really bought low on Michael Burnham. She popped out of a space butthole, and he was like, hey, I'm gonna, you know, hitch my wagon to you and see where it takes me. Hey, great news. Within 1 year, I was saving my entire home planet.
Yeah, it worked out pretty well for him. Yeah. I like that he wasn't on board from jump. I like that his place there had to be proven, or he had to be sold on staying, and that sales job is now complete.
A brief scene where Stamets and Culber stand over the sleeping teen genius Adira, who has finished their algorithm.
Why do they work Adira so hard?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like Stamets worked that hard this episode.
No, and Stamets would be a fucking asshole if they tried to work him that hard in the beginning either. Like, he would resist.
Yeah. And the button on the episode is a scene with Book and Michael Burnham. Adam, is Book going to be made the XO?
Wow, I wasn't even thinking about that.
Because he says, like, I'm going to stick around, I think. And she says, like, you're going to have to, like, take that up with the captain.
I
don't know.
I love the idea. I mean, as much as I love a Sylvia Tilly, it seems like Book is an asset in this universe and not a liability.
He knows his way around the future in a way that none of them do.
Yeah. Yeah, Book's not going to be going over meeting appointments in Saru's calendar, though.
Yeah. Saru's going to be like, what cool catchphrase can I use? And Book is going to be like, I don't fucking know, mate. Like, fucking miss me with that.
Book's first order of business is like, hey, I got you these gloves. They just fit over your fingers. They're finger-full gloves, not finger-less gloves, see?
I've fallen into a trance looking at wormy things before, but this is ridiculous.
Hey, those things are worms that make me want to kill myself. Those worms don't have to do it for me.
That's our episode, Adam. Did you like this episode of Star Trek Discovery?
I mean, story-wise, this is another episode with another planet with a problem to solve. And we're another step closer to what? Exactly. They don't even call back this ship at all. Like, once the computation is done, shouldn't that have been a moment where, all right, dishes are done, man. Now let's go save this other ship. I wanted to be thinking about that the entire episode, and I was prevented from doing so. So I hate fighting with the episode about what it thinks is important. And I feel like this is one of those episodes where I was in conflict with it throughout, you know? And I think that makes it hard for me to like this ep individually. I'm still enjoying the season. I'm still very open to where it takes me, but I don't think this episode didn't feel like a great step forward in the story. I guess we met Osyra.
Yeah, we met Osyra.
In meeting her, we also took her off the board, too, because if she has this Achilles heel with the dilithium, like, all you have to do is wait her out. Like, what's the threat there? Have we removed the threat of Osyra with this news?
I'm curious about that, because I do feel like season three has more conflict with season one and two than within itself, almost. Because season one and two taught us about a very different type of show. And I'm super happy with the direction they're taking it in season three. But I feel like all of our instincts about what the import of a development might be are fucked up because of the way seasons one and two worked.
Because seasons one and two had that point on the horizon that was like unquestionably the place where we're headed.
Yeah.
Directly, like in a straight line. And there are no straight lines this season.
Yeah. I have to say, I kind of liked the episode. I liked the tidiness of it. And I really liked Rin's story. Like I felt like that scene at the end where he explains why he was so hesitant to help earlier on is a really hard thing to achieve, because usually you have to have a character justify not wanting to help before they don't help. And instead they kind of did it backwards, but it worked for me. So I thought that was a really impressive use of story. But I agree, like the planet felt very like we're running around in the forest behind our house with the camera scale of visiting a planet, and you hope with the budget that Star Trek Discovery has that we would get to see a city and some bedraggled locals that are on the verge of famine and like get to know like what we're fighting for in this episode.
Makes me wonder to what extent quarantine was a factor in second unit stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, I wonder, because it was shot before quarantine started, but maybe they still have to go gather second unit stuff or whatever.
Man.
Who knows? But yeah, I'd say overall I liked the episode, but you know, not my favorite of the season by any means.
Right.
You want to see if we have any priority one messages, my friend?
Yeah, let's head over there.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secure channel.
Adam, we have a couple of priority one messages here. The first of them is of a personal nature. It's from Eric, and it's to venting into the empty void that is time.
Hey, get in line, Eric.
Is this the same Eric as last week?
Oh, yeah.
I feel like last week there was also an Eric.
There was Eric of the now, Eric of the future, and now Eric venting into that empty void that is time.
Yeah.
You want to collect all three.
Here's the P1. Jesus, am I watching ST Discovery or 2001 A Space Odyssey? Currently watching Season 2, Episode 14. If there's anything worse than the AU, it's time travel. So far, you guys and the P1s that you allow me to purchase are the only thing that is keeping me going. Wow. Eric, not a fan of the direction of Season 2 of Star Trek Discovery.
I personally think that Season 2 finale is maybe the high point of the series for me. I loved it.
I love what an ambiguous note it goes out on. And I also, I feel like almost all Star Trek time travel is back to the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is the thing that, like, I'm famous for thinking that time travel is generally bad for Star Trek, but this is an instance in which I totally disagree with my fellow time travel hater, Eric.
Hey, I'm glad Eric's sticking around, sticking with the show, sticking with us,
yeah,
and buying P1s.
Eric, there are cheaper ways to start a Star Trek podcast than paying for us to say your opinions about Star Trek.
Yeah, there's a way to do that. Actually, I mean, podcasting has become very expensive. If I didn't have the energy for podcasting, I might just make P1s too.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Ben, our second priority one message is from Lorny CB. It's to Michael B. And the message goes like this. After freeloading off of your Maximum Fund subscription for over a year, I thought it was time I paid my share and made a donation to our best friends we've never actually met, Ben and Adam. Thank you for introducing me to them and being the best lockdown companion anyone could ask for. Well done, us, for making it this far. All my love always, Lorny CB.
Aww.
I might put us squarely in the crosshairs of our network and friend of Benjamin R. Harrison, Jesse Thorne.
Wouldn't be the first time.
I feel like when you're in the same household, you could make the case that sharing the Maximum Fund subscription is a thing that you can do.
It's, yeah, but that's not, Lorny CB got a P1, so it's like they've got the subscription and they've got the P1 now. You know,
I just don't want Lorny CB to feel guilty about the arrangement here.
Yeah, that's fair. But I also appreciate the support because we need all the support we can get.
That's true. That's true. We could just be an Eric buying P1s to make our opinions about the show instead of an expensive to produce podcast.
Spout our cranky Star Trek opinions off into the void.
About that.
Well, thank you, Lorny and Michael and Eric and time travel, one and all, for supporting The Greatest Discovery. If you'd like to get a priority one message on the show, head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself an Edward Larkin?
I'm going to give it to the son of Kaim, because the son of Kaim comes aboard the ship at the end and is told he can peel a piece of Ted's skin off of Linus. And that seems exciting to him. And I feel like when I was a boy, that would have seemed really exciting to me too.
Kids say the darndest things, Ben. I think that was the name of one of your favorite television shows. But yeah, this kid seems like he's of the age of the type that would put Elmer's glue in the palm of his hand and then peel it off when it dries. That's one of the great things to do when you're little. And and Linus has a face that is basically that.
I'm just into that shit. I know it's gross to other people, but like, I was listening to an episode of Judge John Hodgman the other day, and they were talking about a product on Hamaker Schlemmer that you can buy that's a thing that you can stick into your ear, and it broadcasts HD video of the inside of your ear to your phone, so you could scoop out earwax.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
And they were making fun of that, and I was like, I have that, and it's one of my prized possessions.
You have that?
Yeah, I totally have that.
No way. Do you think I could borrow that sometime?
It's not really the kind of thing you share. You can order them off Amazon for a surprisingly reasonable price. I think it's like less than $30.
I've had to join up with my wife's extended family Secret Santa list. And you know they're asking for gift ideas.
This is white elephant written all over it.
This is the perfect white elephant gift. Because when you drop that onto a list of people you barely know, boy, the questions. I can hear them now.
The questions that will primarily be asked behind closed doors by people going, "What the fuck?"
I'll never hear the questions. That's the best part.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also a gift for my wife, those questions.
Did you have an Edward Larkin in this episode, Adam?
Here's the thing, Ben. Detmer kind of jaked Book's ship here. And so that's why Detmer's going to get my Edward Larkin.
Yeah, she kind of did.
Here's a note for Book. You might want to turn on sentry mode on your ship if you were to, if you leave it behind on the disco someone doesn't jake it while you're gone. That'd be a good idea.
If they went down to the shuttle bay and they're like, ah, shit, he left it on cloak. We have no way of getting in.
Is this one of those situations where a police officer is like on a high-speed chase and has to commandeer a civilian's vehicle to use it for official business? Is that what Detmer does to Book ship? This seems way too easy.
Yeah. I always think of the car that you commandeer in a high-speed chase as being like a shitty early 80s Chrysler sedan. So
you want to know what's science fiction about this episode, Ben? That Book isn't fucking pissed about his ship being taken and damaged in the process.
Yeah, he's pretty chill about the 8 points of hull damage from the photon torpedoes hitting it.
Yeah. He's a better man than I.
He's no Han Solo.
Yeah. Well, what do we have coming up on the next episode of Star Trek Discovery, Ben? We really have to go digging to find the preview. What'd you find?
I did find the preview this week. Somebody tweeted it at me because they saw that there is a front zip in the next episode. Like a TNG front zip appears briefly in this trailer. And I mean, come on. What more could you want in an episode of Star Trek Discovery? I mean, I know Eric, the time-traveling P1 writer, is going to be pissed, but
I like a front zip. quite a bit. That's a nice callback.
There was also a blue guy like coming up out of a bio bed looking very distressed, and I wondered if that was Rin or someone else. I don't know.
So it was a package of vignettes. You didn't get a scene per se.
Didn't really get a scene. It was a proper edited promo. But it looks like the bespectacled interlocutor that is the foil for Mug is going to be back as well.
Oh, I'm excited for David Cronenberg's return. Very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. So looking forward to next week, but we got to leave it with Robs from here. We've given him a very fat episode to edit. Sorry, Robs.
Sorry, Robs. We love you. We love you this much. I just held out my hands at a width of 90 minutes.
Yeah. At the length of the timeline.
Yeah.
All right. Take it away, Robs.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison and produced by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is by Adam Ragusea, who happens to have a fairly successful YouTube cooking channel that you should all go check out. And if you'd like to listen to more Trek, why don't you dive into our back catalog? There's a lot of episodes to discover. We've covered every season of Star Trek Discovery, Picard, Lower Decks, some comic books, some interviews. It's a whole lot of fun. And don't forget, you can now follow us on Twitter and Instagram under the handles Greatest Trek. Those social media accounts are run by the great Bill Tilly, and we really appreciate that. Thank you, Bill. If you'd like to help out the podcast even more, why don't you head to MaximumFun.org/join and become a member. For as little as $5 a month, you'll gain access to all the Maximum Fun bonus content. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Greatest Discovery.
Excuse me, sir. I'm with the San Francisco Police Department. This is official police business. I would like to commandeer this vehicle.
No.
What do you mean, no?
I happen to know for a fact that you don't have the right to commandeer my vehicle.
Please, can I commandeer this vehicle?
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.